You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Well, one of the questions they asked me was, for any amount of money, would you ever go against America? What about $1 million? What about $2 million? And they kept on upping the ante.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Jay Lieberman talks about his early childhood memories of the Cold War, as well as his long career in the US Navy. He tells a fascinating story of how he obtained high security clearance in the US Navy and served at a number of classified command facilities, including the 2nd Pentagon and the Fleet Ocean Surveillance Information Facility at Rota in Spain. Now, I know I keep saying if this was a magazine, you wouldn't mind paying a few quid or dollars a week. Well, it's true. I'm just asking you for the bargain price of $3 US a month. And you'll also get that sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster too. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you listen via Apple Podcasts, then do leave us a written review. It really helps us get new guests on the show and raises our profile. Now, this conversation was recorded as part of the Imperial War Museum North Voices of the Wall event commemorating 30 years since the fall of the wall. We welcome Jay Lieberman to our Cold War conversation. Jay, I understand you had an earlier experience of the Cold War in your childhood.
Yes, when I was in elementary school or primary school, as you know it here, we had air raid drills constantly. I was schooled in New York, so it was quite a bit of ways from Florida, but the Cuban Missile Crisis was on. And frequently we had air raid drills where I had to hide under my desk or actually go find the air raid shelter. And I was 9, 10, 11 years old at the time. And that's when it really came to light that this is not a game. This is real. And thankfully, it turned out the way it did.
Yeah. And were those drills taken very seriously then in those days?
Oh, absolutely, because we did not know the full capabilities of Cuba at the time. And we didn't know the range of their missiles. So it wasn't anything that we took lightly. We had to take it seriously because we just didn't know.
Because I've seen films of those drills where the siren goes off and the street's empty. Was that really what it was like? The whole city would shut down?
Yeah, exactly. Most of the time when I had those drills, I was in school. But when the air raid shelters went, when the sirens went, everybody did evacuate. It was like a ghost town. It's just unbelievable. And you can still go back to America and in some cases still see the poles with the horns on the top of the sirens. And the sound of the sirens just, the range was so great, but they had them frequently so everybody could hear them and there wasn't any misunderstanding of what those were about. The other issue is in some of my schools locally, they had, just outside the grounds, they had, missile batteries set up, called them Nike missile batteries, in protection of the area from any incoming missiles from the Cold War.
Right, so this was an early anti-ballistic missile system.
Yes,
yeah, absolutely. I've heard about these sites around Los Angeles, and in fact I've seen the there are some posts there with the siren still on.
Yes,
in central Los Angeles as well.
That's right. And we just didn't know at the time whether what was going to happen. And we had, of course, America had experience in the wars, and so we just didn't know what was going to happen, so we had to take those precautions.
And so what made you join the U.S. Navy?
Well, when I left high school at age 18, and I went to my local college for a year, and I felt I wasn't getting my money's worth, Plus, Vietnam was on during the time. It was the end of the Vietnam War, but we still had a conscripted service, or draft, as we call it. And I didn't want to have them say, you're going here. I wanted to have the choice. And so I talked to all the different recruiters, and I said immediately no to the Army and the Marines. Jokingly said I didn't want to walk around looking like a tree. So went in and talked to the Air Force recruiter, misunderstood him, went in and spoke to the Navy recruiter, and he was going to send me away right then and that day. That was May. And I said, well, no, let's hold off until we finally decided on a date of the 24th of October, 1973.
Right. And where did you first serve?
Well, once I got done with basic training and my initial schooling, I actually, and this was early 1974, so Vietnam was still on, I was transferred to a ship out of Rota, Spain. It's called the USS Simon Lake, and it looked after submarines. And the interesting point about that time was, that was 1974 to 1976. When I first got stationed there, General Franco was still alive. And so we had that era of the Spanish civilization and everything. And then he died in 1975, halfway through my time there. Things changed a little, but not a lot. And in 1976, I got transferred off of that ship as a normal rotation.
And it's interesting because people, I think, forget that, you know, Franco was a semi-ally of Hitler. Certainly Hitler aided his success in the Spanish Civil War. Mm. There was a division, the Spanish division, sent to the Soviet Union to fight against the Soviet Union. Mm. I mean, what was it like in Franco Spain? Were you given special briefing as to how to behave when you were ashore?
Well, the ship was homeported there, so I was able to live out in town. But just outside the gates of the base were the infamous Spanish La Guardia Civil. And these are the Spanish national police with the black hats.
Like the tricorn.
Yes.
Hats.
Yes. And there was a story of an American Navy chief that was leaving the base. So you go through the gate, you show your ID card to the U.S. authorities, and then you stop for La Guardia Civil. This chief did not stop for whatever reason. So they just took out their submachine guns and shot the back window out of the car and killed him because he did not stop. This is the type of power that they had at the time. When Franco died, a lot of that changed. And when I went back in the mid to late 80s, they were pretty much gone. It was pretty much a cursory of at the gate, okay, bye. Yeah. Type of scenario. But yes, in the mid 70s, it was a difficult time. You had to watch your P's and Q's.
Yeah. And you said that the ship that you were serving on was it submarine resupply ship?
Or? Yes. The submarines would go out on their patrol and then come back, and we would offload and unload new missiles, new torpedoes, and we'd perform any maintenance work that needed to be done. We also had a dry dock behind us where the subs, if needed be, could go into the dry dock and do some work. So it was an interesting time there. It was there for 2 years.
Yeah. So these were hunter-killer submarines?
Yes. Well, these were some hunter-killers, and then some of them were long-range ballistics. They had at least a dozen to two dozen missile tubes on them.
Okay, so these were there were some Polaris?
Yes, exactly.
Submarines there? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, I don't pretend to know all my submarines, but I knew that one, mainly because the Brits had them as well.
They were all nuclear submarines, so we had the nuclear issue, and because of that, I had to have somewhat of a security clearance. And, of course, whatever maintenance needed to be done. We certainly did not want our enemies to know that this particular submarine needed this or how many missiles it needed or anything else. So there was that bit of secrecy involved, because you never want to give away your capabilities or your lack of capabilities to the other guy.
Absolutely. Mm. And so you were there for 3 years, did you say?
2 years.
2 years.
I left there in 1976 to be stationed in Washington, D.C., during the 200th birthday party of our liberation from the Queen. So, and that was another intelligence situation. The place was actually called Naval Intelligence Processing System Support Activity.
Nice and punchy name, though.
Oh, absolutely. NIPSA for short. So I was there during the 200th anniversary. And then from there, again, because of my high security clearance and my good service record, I got stationed to another base that people say, well, how did you ever get there? I got stationed in Stuttgart, Germany.
As far away as you can get from the sea as possible, really,
exactly.
In Europe.
It was another two-year stint there. It was joint service. We had everybody there. It was Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. The highest-ranking naval officer was a two-star admiral there, right. And all the way down to somebody as junior as me.
Can you tell me anything about what your role was there and what you were doing?
Right. Well, the whole time I was in the Navy, I was a computer operator of sorts. So it's all different computer systems. This particular computer system was one of the very first ones in the world to be able to communicate to somebody on the other side of the world. So in computer parlance back then, we would take a paper tape and run it through the machine, and that would open up the communication channels between us and the same type of installation on the other side of the world. So we were in constant contact with, there were about a half a dozen of these sites throughout the world at the time, including the primary Pentagon, as we know it, the secondary Pentagon, which we can go on to later, and some of the other sites. So it was keeping all of the U.S. forces throughout the world in contact with one another without going over the, without sending messages, and of course, without sending letters or anything else like that. So it was instant communication.
Right. And this was via radio transmission or?
It was via the predecessors to the internet. So okay. It was all secure, highly classified data that was going back and forth.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Fascinating. Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating stuff. It must have been an interesting project to work on.
Oh, absolutely. Because it was the up-and-coming thing in computers. And this was when computers were big, power-hungry machines and cabinets that you needed huge air conditioning systems to keep the computer room cold. In Fahrenheit, it was about 65 degrees in there.
Yeah.
And we had to work in there 8 to 12 hours, depending upon your shift. And it was just processing the data and keeping up where all of our other resources were and how available those resources were to the U.S. military should they need to shift them in time of crisis.
So it was tracking readiness status and all of that information that would have been really useful to an enemy order to work out when to attack.
Exactly.
Okay. And how long were you serving in Stuttgart for?
I was in Stuttgart for 2 years. In the U.S. Navy, when you go to a shore command, if you're single, you go there for 2 years. If you're married, you go there for 3 years just to make it cost worthy. When I went there, I was single. Halfway through, I got married, but I got my wife command sponsored, which means the Navy paid for her from that point forward. So I was lucky enough to only be there for 2 years, and then I transferred out.
And when you were sent to Stuttgart, because you're obviously outside of the U.S., were you given any special training or advice because you're in such a sensitive position as to being conscious of maybe approaches from other intelligence services, let's say?
Well, the security briefings started when I was actually in Washington, the command previous. And a bit of an anecdote here. When an American eats, we move our fork back and forth between our two hands. The Europeans don't. And there's a story of during World War II, there was an American that was so in depth in the German environment, you speaking to him and looking at him and his mannerisms were so German, you couldn't tell that he was not German until you watched him eat. He switched his fork around and that's how he got caught. So it's either some of the stories that we get talked about, And, you know, they say if you're ever approached by anybody that you don't know, you raise the flag because you just never know if this guy's a good guy or a bad guy.
And I guess prior to you meeting your wife, being single as well potentially made you more vulnerable to approaches. Or were you advised just not to fraternize with the local population?
Well, no, my wife was American, but it is they look at your financial condition. So if you're constantly in debt, that's an easy target. If at that point your sexual preferences, if they were not a heterosexual preference, they looked at that as a point. If you were involved with anything else, any drugs or anything, again, that is a point that they can exploit. So they, when we went through our annual periodic security reviews, they'd ask you this, this, and this, and this. Not that they were going to go ahead and prosecute you for doing these things, but it's one less thing that they can bring against you, the spies can bring against you, because the commander already knew that I did this, did that, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, it's interesting. I did a recent interview with somebody who served on Polaris with the Royal Navy, and some of the vetting there was pretty similar, including political persuasion and,
exactly.
And those areas as well.
Well, one of the questions they asked me was, for any amount of money, would you ever go against America? What about $1 million? What about $2 million? And they kept on upping the ante, and they just needed to know, am I at any point willing to give up my
loyalty?
My loyalty to America. And so, that's the briefings we had all the time. And it didn't stop in Germany. It went and continued on throughout my whole career in the military, because my very, very last command was an intelligence type command. So they wanted to make sure that I was worthy of it.
Was that with lie detector attached as well or not?
No, it was no lie detectors, but it was all written statements. And then they would type up the statement, and then I have to sign the statement initial and say yes, and then sign what you know as the Official Secrets Act.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Fascinating, Jay. Fascinating. And so what was next after Stuttgart?
From Stuttgart, it was one of our big super carriers out of the west coast of California, out of San Diego. It's called the USS Ranger. And there I worked with the airplanes that went out and searched for submarines. And again, I needed a security clearance because of the capabilities of these airplanes and how they analyzed their data to determine, was it a submarine, was it an aircraft carrier, whatever. And I was on there for 3 years. The first deployment we went on, we were actually in the mouth of the Persian Gulf when the American hostages were released from the Tehran embassy. So that was quite a momentous occasion for us.
So did you receive, were they flown by civilian airliner out, or were they, so they weren't received on the aircraft carrier, were
no,
they?
No, no, they weren't. But our planes were there, keeping a constant eye on all the air traffic in the area and escorted. Once the hostages were transferred from the Tehran embassy to a neutral embassy and then from there to the American embassy, of course, they were escorted out, and our planes, along with the other carriers that were there, were part of that mission.
Yeah.
Now, my carrier wasn't the only one there, and each American aircraft carrier has 5,000 people and about 100 airplanes. So there were three of these things floating around in the Indian Ocean, and there was another one floating around in the Mediterranean. So 20,000 people, 400 airplanes, and all of our escort ships were all up in that area looking out for the Americans coming out of Tehran.
So you weren't there for the abortive rescue mission?
No, that happened before I got there.
Right. Okay. Okay. And so as far as the surveillance, I mean, I've spoken to some Royal Canadian Air Force mm-hmm. crew who were involved in the patrols out over the mm-hmm. Atlantic, and they reckon that they could pick up any submarine, friendly or otherwise, mm-hmm. Because I was saying to them, well, mm-hmm. you know, the story we're told in the UK with Polaris, mm-hmm. as it was then, okay, mm-hmm. it's Trident now, is that it's absolutely invisible. It cannot be found unless it's surfaced or unless it's transmitting. How true would you say that is?
I will cough, cough, sputter, sputter on that one. Because everything in the world makes a noise. And that is how we detect ships in the ocean. And that's how we can determine the difference between the new Prince of Wales aircraft carrier.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And the Queen Elizabeth II aircraft carrier, it makes a slightly different noise. And that's how we did it. A lot of people like to say that their submarines and so forth are undetectable. Some are harder to detect than others, but we'll get them.
Yeah. Well, no, I interviewed a guy who'd written a book on the Dutch submarine service during mm-hmm. the Cold War, which was really fascinating because mm-hmm. I hadn't realized the operations they were on in the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the different acoustic signatures of different submarines, ships. And he said one of the challenges they had was there was a Russian trawler that used the same type of engine that mm-hmm. one of the Russian submarines mm-hmm. used, and so it had a similar signature. But it was really interesting as to how they recorded this stuff and then how it was used to identify.
That's right. It is a science on its own. And the guys that I actually worked with that took the tapes back and analyzed it, they had to have a very, very sharp ear. It's the slightest change, the slightest cavitation in the water would be able to detect, well, that is that, and that is that. When I left Ranger, a couple of commands later, I actually got heavily involved in that. And part of my briefing during the day was, and I'm going to use the British aircraft carriers as an example, the Queen Elizabeth II class aircraft carrier Prince of Wales. So we determined the class of ship, and then the actual ship is here, here, and here, and we're able to distinguish it because of the noise they make. I mean, to give you an example, if you buy a car and I buy one, the next car off the assembly line, and they're exactly the same specification, mine is still going to make a different noise than yours. And that's how they do it.
Yeah. And with the Ranger, presumably there were various exercises you were involved in as well. I mean, what sort of scenarios were they looking to, you know, cover?
Well, one of the things that we did on our way across the Pacific, we actually picked up 140 Vietnamese boat people. And this was like 1980, but they still wanted to leave Vietnam for a better place. But the exercises overall was possible an aerial attack, possibly surface or subsurface attack. And this involved our submarines and our radar airplanes and all of our escort ships. Unfortunately, later on, when the Middle East got really, really touchy, one of our American cruisers shot down an American, a civilian airliner.
Yeah, that was the Vincennes, wasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Because that airliner did not respond as it should. And they thought it was an enemy airplane. So these are the issues that they had, and they wanted to be prepared for those issues, and they wanted to make sure that we did the right thing. Unfortunately, in that case, it didn't. It was partially, why did we shoot down an airliner? Part of it was that they never responded accordingly. So if you don't respond, you consider it a hostile, and then you take appropriate action.
Yeah. So you were there also around the time of the Falklands War. What was the sort of U.S. Navy's view of the Royal Navy's capabilities?
Well, the Falklands, of course, was in the Atlantic, and I was in the Pacific, if I remember correctly. We kept a close eye on it because we are allies, and we were there for support in other ways. But what the Falklands War did teach us is that aluminum ships are not worth the money spent on them. We had a collision between one of our cruisers and our aircraft carriers in the mid-70s, And it was an aluminum superstructure, and it just melted due to the sheer heat. And of course, England lost a ship due to that reason. So there was a lessons learned from that, both in the UK and the US, on how to build ships or how not to build ships. But we certainly helped out. There were lessons learned from both sides. Because it was an internal battle between the UK and Argentina, and it didn't affect any of us in the US per se, we weren't really that affected by it, the actual combat situation.
Because I understand that some U.S. intelligence was passed to the U.S., to the Royal Navy in terms of location of Argentine warships and such like.
Well, I'm sure you're aware that the Belgrano, the Argentine battleship that was sunk, was originally an American ship.
Yeah, that was at Pearl Harbor on the 7th of December, 1941 as well. Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm sure that bit of intelligence was passed across. Yeah, here's the weak spot.
I think our nervousness was around the carrier they had, the 7th of May. Mm. I think it was called, although it was quite an elderly ship, as was, I think, most of the Argentine Navy. Mm. But Jay, that's been really interesting, that piece. So what was next for you after the Ranger?
From the Ranger is when I went to, here's a bit of alphabet soup for you, A&M, CC, COD, JDSSC, DCA.
Right, don't test me on that later.
I didn't think so. In standard parlance, literally, it was the second Pentagon. So if the Pentagon had to be evacuated, that's where they would go. There was a lift, a presidential lift in the back of the computer room that I worked in. Again, it was a joint service command, but if the Pentagon had to be evacuated, that's where they went. It's a quarter mile underground. It was built during the Cold War. It was built to withstand conventional weaponry, but we still used it not because where it was. Everybody knew where it was. Of course, you can look it up on the map, but because of the facilities there. And we were in very, very close contact with the Pentagon. So when their computer systems were down, ours couldn't be. And we transferred data back and forth frequently. And literally, like I said, it was the second Pentagon. While we were in there, I was actually working that day. One of the other ladies that I worked with came in a very high-pitched, shrilly voice. And I'm not going to repeat it, but she kept on saying, "Oh, my God, oh, my God." And I said, "What's the matter, Pam?" And she said, "The Challenger space shuttle just blew up." And we all thought it was a joke because there was no TVs in there. Unfortunately, it was real. But there was no TVs in our computer room. They were so deep underground that we couldn't put anything in there. We had that one TV, and that was with an aerial running up to the top of the mountain. So we played a lot of jokes with people, but it was a very serious place where it was.
So was this Cheyenne? This isn't Cheyenne Mountain. This is somewhere else.
This is in the Maryland-Pennsylvania borderline. It's about two mountains over from the presidential retreat called Camp David. Very, very beautiful countryside. Yeah. Better than the Lake District. Sorry.
God, you're fighting talk, Jay.
Yeah, I know. From there, I went back to Spain, the same place where I was on the first ship. And that was
Can I just go back to, so the second Pentagon was effectively a backup data center, or was it also offices and the ability to operate as another Pentagon as well?
Oh, absolutely. The command center was literally above the computer room. We had a cafeteria in there. We had medical and dental facilities. And we had a store of military rations there that lasted, I think they were able to feed about 300 people for 3 months, all underground waiting to be used.
Yeah.
It was huge.
And presumably you were plugged into the NORAD network as well, so you were seeing what they were seeing as well. Did you experience any of the false alarms that occurred?
What was plugged into NORAD was upstairs in the command center. So when they had these exercises and these drills and these real-life scenarios, I didn't see them because I was down in the computer room below them, but it was certainly on a heightened state of alert in that, don't do anything wrong, don't do anything unexpected, you know, you're there, get to make sure the computer was up and running the whole time. Because this computer was one of the same ones that was tied into the network that I talked about previously in Germany. It was a computer system called Worldwide Military Command and Control System. So it was all tied in together, everybody talking to themselves.
Yeah. And so this was the forerunner of the internet.
Exactly.
Because it was designed to survive damage to any of its nodes and still be able to communicate with all the areas.
Exactly. We had all the four services there, the military services, and we had a lot of civilian contractors working in there. And the civilian contractors were able to go home every day. But to get into the place, you had to show your ID card three times, walk through airport-style security, show your badge another time, and get transferred to transfer that badge for another one.
Wow.
Yeah, it was an experience.
Top security.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so after your work at the Second Pentagon, you go back to Spain?
Yes, a place called, another alphabet soup, called FOSIF, or Fleet Ocean Surveillance Information Facility. And that was pretty much keeping an eye out of all the military activity within the European theater. Another very, very highly classified place. Another one where you had to get your badge checked 3 or 4 times before you walked in. And that was a very interesting thing, because our commanding officer wanted to try every new bit of kit that there was out there. So if it was new, it could do this, he wanted it.
Sounds a bit dangerous.
Oh, it was. It was. But one of our guys was actually in the Air Force. He was stationed with us. And he went on one of our Navy destroyers up into the Black Sea and had a bit of an encounter, shall I say, with the comrades. So that was highly classified for quite a long time. But we talk about that all the time.
And can you tell me anything about that incident?
Well, the American destroyer was in the Black Sea, which enough is enough, you know, put it close enough to Russia at the time. And one of their destroyers decided to come out and pay them a visit. And they got a bit too close for comfort.
I think I might have seen footage of this where they actually are in contact with each other.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I'll dig that out on YouTube, and we'll be sharing that as part of the the show notes. I think I am familiar with the incident there.
I mean, that goes with goes back with the Cold War of playing cat and mouse and teasing the enemy and their capabilities. Russia and China and us in the UK, we were doing it back and forth to see what the capabilities are of your opponent. And then what you can do is you can exploit the weaknesses and hopefully get the upper hand.
And so you said that you were... The operation in Spain was checking the military readiness. Mm-hmm. That's the military readiness of the U.S. forces in Europe. Or was it looking at the opposition as well, the comrades, as you fondly call them?
It was everybody's. When the daily briefing went out, and the daily briefing was giving locations of ships and last known contact and tracking of enemy aircraft, because you can't, aircraft move so fast, it's very, very quick. But we can say that this particular guy took off from here and went to there. Or last known location of this particular Russian ship was here, and the type of ship it was and the name of the ship. And we also knew the way the Russians tried to disguise their ships. And I think they still do it today, so I won't go any further. But it is interesting to try to keep track of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So what year was that you were there?
It was 1986 to 1988.
Okay. Because I was almost hoping you were there in 1983, because I was I'm always fascinated by Able Archer.
Mm.
And you know that I hear stories around that the Soviets were taking this seriously. There were planes at the end of runways and things like that. I don't know whether you can shed any light on that.
Well, 1983, I was still on the USS Ranger. Out of San Diego, California, and then I transferred to the Second Pentagon. But that was a time when everybody was on edge. That was a time that the U.S. realized that we need to keep an airplane in the air 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. for surveillance, et cetera, et cetera. So them, the Russians doing what they were doing would not surprise me. As we were in Spain, it was a Spanish naval base, and they were flying 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, testing their capabilities. Because everybody's got their right to their own sovereignty.
Yeah. Yeah, because in 83, I know the U.S. were doing exercises in almost the Soviet equivalent of the Black Sea near Japan and were flying towards the Soviet coast to test out, you know, waiting for the Soviets to switch on their radar. And the Soviets were doing similar things to us. But obviously then there was the KAL 007 shoot down where the Soviets say they thought it was a U.S. surveillance aircraft.
That's right.
I mean, what's your view? Do you think that is just a – it was just a screw-up at the end of it? Or were the U.S. were flying flights like that close to the Soviet Union and –
Well, there was one time one of our military surveillance planes that had to make an emergency landing someplace. And there was a big hoopla. Oh, was it planned? Are they spying on us? And this. I'm sure surveillance flights went back and forth between all the countries. Again, it's to test the capabilities. If you send a military airplane out, people are going to know that's a military airplane and what they're doing. That's overt. But if you do use a civilian airliner, that's covert, and that's how you get your information. It might have been just a trigger happy guy at the end of the radar system that didn't wait for a response back from the KAL, or maybe KAL didn't respond as they should have, and they were getting close to airspace.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
The airspace and sea borders are always touchy subjects, especially in that neck of the world. A lot of people believe in the 12-mile limit, but a lot of people also only believe in the 3-mile limit. And you see that right now in the South China Sea.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Again, I overuse the word interesting in this podcast, but I never fail to be fascinated by the stories from some of my guests. So you're working in that completely unpronounceable acronym in Spain until 88.
That is correct. And I stayed in Spain, but went to another place that flew the antiquated EA-3B Sky Warrior surveillance planes. They went again. This was during the end of the Cold War, but they were up there flying, doing their things. They had two different types of airplanes, but they went all over the place. None of the planes are flying anymore. They're just too old. They've taken them out. In fact, the squadron has been decommissioned. Again, at very, very high security clearance. So I was there for 2 years. During that time, I got married to my current wife, and my little daughter was born in Spain.
Okay. Does she claim Spanish citizenship, or does it not work that way in Spain?
Well, she probably could have, but she's got an American and British passport, and she chose to go that route.
Yeah, that's probably enough nationalities to deal with there. So, you know, when the Berlin Wall falls, what do you see from your position in terms of, you know, you're looking at the readiness of Soviet and Warsaw Pact forces. What are you seeing at that point?
Well, the operations tempo, I would have thought, had been reduced because the world opened up, for lack of a better term. But speaking with my colleagues, it actually increased because now we get to see the capabilities of the other side in the open. And now you might have the great influx of espionage created because of all the people coming from back and forth. So the operations tempo actually increased quite a bit during that time. It spiked, I think it would be the proper term. I was in Spain at the time, so I wasn't, I remember seeing it on the TV. But yeah, these guys said, yeah, the ops tempo increased quite a bit.
Because, you know, obviously, I spoke to an RAF pilot who saw the MiG-29 come to his airbase in Scotland for an air show. So NATO was getting a real up-close look at this tech. In your view, were some of the fears overly emphasized about the capabilities of Warsaw Pact forces?
I don't know if we overemphasized them, but the technology at that point, the Russian technology, was behind the American technology and the British technology. So when these air shows came about, of course, we got a glint of what they had in store and their capabilities. But if you also take a look at the Russian philosophy, the Soviet Union philosophy of their Navy was, we're going to stay in port and we're going to be ready to deploy at a moment's notice. The U.S. philosophy is, we're going to deploy and be there then and there. And yes, it's a bit more wear and tear on the ships, but we're already forward deployed. The Russians weren't that way. They believed, well, when something happens, we'll send somebody. And their state of readiness wasn't the greatest because if you don't use something, when you need to use it, it doesn't work. So we were constantly on the lookout, constantly deployed and constantly looking at what was going on. And when the Berlin Wall fell, we did see, all of a sudden we saw some other ships started leaving and, going out and exploring, and we went out to look at their capabilities and realized, oh, wait a minute, this is something that we possibly something that we missed. And if you take a look at some of the Russian fighter planes, they look a lot like the Western fighter planes because of reverse technology. And these air shows certainly helped them out as it helped us out. So we knew their capabilities.
Were you using some of the information from units like the U.S. Military Liaison Unit in East Germany and BRICSMIS in some of these assessments?
As much as we could, yes. Now, the British government and the American government have this special relationship, so we do share data. We share a lot more data between us than America, let's say, would share with Turkey. And we're very careful on our contracts with who we're going to sell our weapon systems to. And just of late, we were going to pull out of a contract to sell our new airplanes to Turkey because at the same time they bought the Russian defense systems. And then they said, no, you're not going to do that because that would know our capabilities so the Russians can build and you can build a system to take out our planes. And we're not going to do that. And it's all cat and mouse.
Yeah, yeah. So did you leave the Navy in 88?
No, in 1988, I transferred to that squadron in Spain that I was telling you about, a Fleet Air Reconnaissance Squadron 2. Then in 1990, I transferred to one of our amphibious assault ships out of Norfolk, Virginia, the USS Saipan. It handled boats. It took small boats, helicopters, Harrier airplanes. And the first place we deployed to from Norfolk, Virginia, was into Kuwait City. And we were the first ship to pull into Kuwait City after the first Gulf War hostilities stopped. So we were there for that, and we floated around that area for quite some time. The next time we went on deployment, we went up into the Adriatic. And this was when Kosovo and Bosnia-Herzegovina were kicking off. And our ship was involved with the rescuing of a downed American U.S. pilot and the Harriers on board that. So I was on there from 90 to 93 out of Norfolk, Virginia.
So did you say you were involved in a rescue of a downed U.S.
Me personally, no, but the ship was. Yeah. And the Harrier airplanes provided close air support while the rescue teams went in and got this guy.
Yeah, because I can't remember the name of the film, but there's a film set in the Yugoslav Civil War with a downed US pilot, and it's quite a famous actor in it.
I'll have to look that one up.
I'll email it to you. You'll probably completely pull it apart and say it's good. Gene Hackman is the naval commander, and he's sort of like, we're going to go in and get our guy. And, you know, it's one of those gung-ho.
You sure that wasn't Crimson Tide?
No. that is the role that he plays in almost every not almost every film. I'm doing him a great disservice there. So, Gene, if you're listening, you're a great actor in every role. I can't remember what it's called, but I'll drop you an email. I'll let you know what that is. So is that your final posting?
Actually, no. From there, I did have enough time in service to retire. But I didn't think I didn't feel it was the right time to retire. So the Navy gave me the following options: to go to Hawaii, Sigonella, Sicily, back to Rota, Spain, or there were 5 jobs available in London, England. So I said, oh, I think I'll go to London, being my wife British, and never been stationed there. And my in-laws were here in Manchester. So I accepted those orders and arrived here December of 93. Mid-1995, I got my final promotion. And then in January 1998 is when I retired. I had enough.
That's quite a length of service there as well. But some really interesting roles there. Yeah. I mean, some really interesting roles.
The place in London was called Commander-in-Chief U.S. Naval Forces Europe. And the building was Eisenhower's headquarters during World War II.
I think I know the square it's on because there's a plaque out
exactly.
Outside there.
Well, it's now luxury apartments, but it was the lease, I think, was £99 a year. So it was really ridiculous. But it was because of the economics of the place, it was getting too expensive to keep us there. The rent was cheap, but it was the support and everything else. So eventually they closed down and moved everybody to, I think it was Naples, Italy. And that whole building and the whole support network has since been shut down. Yeah. And that was it.
So if you look back at your Cold War career, Jay, what would you say is your most fondest memory?
Wow. I think it was going to places that I'd never been to before and also learning about the capabilities of the U.S. forces and learning some of the capabilities of our allies. Because of the roles that I was in, I was able to do that. And I wouldn't have gone to a lot of these places if it wasn't for the military.
And don't worry, this is my last question, this one, Jay. But looking back again, I mean, what would you say was the most surprising thing that you experienced in your career that you thought, wow, I never knew that, or that was really unexpected?
Well, of course, not knowing about the alternate Pentagon, didn't know that was there, that even existed. The other thing that amazed me was actually the logistics on how we kept our ships supplied. There is no Tesco's, there is no Sainsbury's or anybody else like that in the middle of the ocean. So how do you get your spare parts out there? How do you get your food out there? And how we can survive out there? The longest we were out to sea without hitting port was 2 months. And you don't have 2 months worth of food out there. So you had the exercise of getting everything out there and how we did it and how we did it professionally and how we as the United States and you as the United Kingdom do it the same way we do, how well we do it as compared to some of the other countries that don't have the same capabilities. Yeah, it was really good. I mean, the most favorite place was Spain. I was there for a total of 6 years. Absolutely loved it.
And I think you're right. I think logistics is a lot of people see it as a boring subject, but without that, there's no way an army can fight. That's right. I mean, it's absolute backbone, mm-hmm. stomach, you know, whatever. And I mean, it's incredible to be able to sustain a mission mm-hmm. on a ship for 2 months.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at World War II, what were the RAF's targets in Germany? They weren't the troops. It was the supply line. You look at the U-boats in the Atlantic. What were they after? They were after the supply ships. And we did the same thing. The U.S. did the same thing in the Pacific. Yes, we wanted to knock out the troops, but we also targeted the supply line. And once you do that, you're pretty much going to starve people out of their stores and their supplies. You look at the Middle East, Masada, back in biblical times, they just blocked the supply lines. And this is what brings people, the forces down. It's not the manpower, it's the lack of food supplies or whatever.
Absolutely. Mm. Jay, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for sharing your story on Cold War Conversations.
Absolute, absolute pleasure. Anytime.
If you'd like to learn more about the subjects covered in this episode, do visit our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app, or visit coldwarconversations.com. If you like what you're listening to, you can really help us by leaving reviews in Apple Podcasts, our Facebook page, or with your favorite podcast app. This really helps raise our profile and get new guests on the show. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where our guests and listeners, just like you, continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at Cold War Pod and Instagram where we are at Cold War Conversations. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.